Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by the Final Destination series. By the way, can anyone tell us what the word final means? And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to MacGuffin Men, everybody. I'm Alex. James will be joining me shortly. I just wanted to take care of, I suppose, what could be called a house cleaning item. We've set up our website to be able to accept donations. I know it's kind of ridiculous for a podcast with 20 listeners to be like, hey, and I think 20 might be a little high, say, hey, if you've got extra money, throw it our way. But here's the reason why. We are looking to expand. We're looking to do a series of video podcasts, like 10-minute video podcasts. We're probably going to do about 13 of them. And the idea we have sketched out right now is really cool, really, really high quality video stuff, using really good equipment, good audio, all that stuff. The problem is, of course, high quality costs money. If you feel like our podcast is worth money, that we haven't been charging you, feel free to donate us. There's a donate button on the top right of the homepage, and I believe every page on the site, actually. And there's a little caveat. If you do donate $10, which I know extremely high amount of money, given that we're asking for money because we don't have any. If you donate $10, you can sponsor an episode. We will have our the voice of the MacGuffin Men either say this episode is sponsored by and your name, or we can write a joke for you. Light ribbing or whatever you want to call it, just a little joke. Please donate. We do work very hard on this podcast. It might be an unserious podcast, but we take it seriously. If you feel the level of quality we give you is worth money, feel free to donate. I mean, obviously at this point, all the money will be going back to the podcast. We want to improve our regular audio podcast quality by getting another mic, all these little things. So thank you very sincerely. Thank you for listening. And if you have extra money floating around that you don't know what to do with, you can give it to us. All right. And now, a podcast about Jurassic Park.
Hey.
Oh, hey, James.
What's up?
Just recording a podcast. Yeah. I would ask you the same, but I know what you're doing.
No, ask me.
Okay. What's up?
My spirits.
Oh.
Because sometimes we do a podcast about a director.
Yep.
That we both like.
Yes, that happens.
Sometimes we do it on a broad topic, like trailers, and we're kind of, indifferent. It's just a subject,
I think we agreed on trailers, but that's...
Just as a topic, I mean.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
And sometimes we do movies that we both dislike, like Twilight.
Yes, yeah, we did.
But this one...
Uh-huh.
We're kind of split on, I think, for the first time in a while, if possibly ever.
There has to be something that we've disagreed on.
I know, but we definitely disagree on points, but I think this is the first movie where we're both on distinctly opposite sides of the line.
Scream movies.
Yeah, but you were wrong about this. That was just empirically incorrect. This is your choice.
You're allowing me to have this opinion.
Anyway, the movie that we are split on and we'll debate for you today.
Yeah.
It's Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
And you didn't say, welcome to the MacGuffin Men. No. The way that you should have. But I'm going to let that slide. We can do that in post.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We're not doing that in post.
We don't have a post.
Anyway. Just to clarify, I am on the side that doesn't love Jurassic Park. Yeah. I suppose I'm playing Devil's Avocado on this one. But James... I assume really likes Jurassic Park.
He
still
hearts Jurassic Park.
Can only be explained by word representing emoticons.
That's right. I love Jurassic Park.
Okay.
I have for a long time.
Yeah.
It came out in 1992?
1993. Yeah.
I got a sneak peek.
Who loves Jurassic Park now? This guy. I know when dates.
So I was what, like 5 years old? What up? That's a good time to be five.
You were born in 1987, right?
Yeah.
You'd be six,
right? It was late birthday.
Okay. Yeah, valid point. Valid point.
This is a summer blockbuster.
Yeah, so June 11th, 1993.
Yeah.
Thanks, Wikipedia.
You're welcome. I speak for Wikipedia.
I was going to say Wikipedia sounds a lot like my co-podcaster, but it was actually you. Okay.
Let's just start on what it is you don't like about Jurassic Park.
I honestly, I mean, as a kid, obviously, I liked this movie.
Okay.
I liked dinosaurs as a kid. I was a child growing up in the 90s. That happens, you know? Like, you're just going to like dinosaurs at that age. Particularly when dinosaurs are culturally ubiquitous and they're just everywhere because of Jurassic Park.
Yeah, I think this is the first time since the discovery... Well, I think since the discovery of dinosaurs... Probably 1993 was the most culturally relevant that dinosaurs probably ever were.
Okay.
What's the argument? Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's A Lost World? Yeah. Really lit up the charts.
I don't think they had charts yet. anyway, the thing I don't like about this movie, and I watched it twice recently.
Did you really?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Trying to do a good podcast.
Yeah. Anyway.
Did you not watch it?
I've seen number three twice in the last week. Oh, that's how committed awful. I am.
My sister and I watched parts of three when it was on TV when I was home on the holidays. Yeah. Bad news.
It's really bad.
It's awful. Anyway, Jurassic Park 1. The thing I don't like about it, and I mean, I loved it as a kid, again, but it's boring. Mm-hmm. It is a boring movie.
Yeah, that's the thing about dinosaurs chasing you. It's so boring.
I got bored both times I watched it.
Okay.
The spectacle aspects of it are cool. There are some great sequences. The T-Rex chase sequence is awesome. The raptors in the kitchen is great. I just don't think there's anything interesting that holds it together.
Okay.
I think it's just sort of things happening. Some of them are cool. And I mean, obviously, like, I like summer blockbusters, so I like these movies. My argument is, I suppose, against people that love this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most beloved and acclaimed film of all time.
Which it's not. No. Yeah, that's my only problem with you. And we've talked about this. This is my only problem with you, is that. No, this is my only problem with you not liking Jurassic Park.
Mm.
Is that you're such a, like, a Michael Bay apologist. And
no, that's true. But that's the thing. Like, I can find things interesting about Michael Bay, to me, more easily than I can find Jurassic Park. And I recognize that people hate Michael Bay movies.
Yeah.
The thing is, people love Jurassic Park. So I don't, like, I'm finding things that I personally enjoy in Michael Bay movies, so I'm allowed to like them, and I'm also defending them. I'm arguing that he's the best action director, you know, and
yeah.
That he's, I recognize that he's low culture, but it says something to me, and I also say he's eventually going to reflect the 2000s better than pretty much anything.
Right.
Whereas Spielberg, he is... he's recognized as the greatest living director, generally, American at least, and people love Jurassic Park pretty much unconditionally. And you know, it's they're on different levels. You know, like I'm allowed to take different stances on the arguments.
Okay, yeah, no, definitely. It just seems when you say that there's that movie together.
No, I know. Look, Transformers. I like Transformers 3 better than I like Transformers 2. Or sorry, better than like Jurassic Park. I recognize that there is far less of a script holding things together in Transformers 3.
Okay.
It's just that, you know, Transformers 3 is awesome in the way that I love awesome. Jurassic Park is cool and it tries to be an actual movie. That's the difference. Michael Bay is just throwing shit at you.
Yeah.
He never apologizes for not trying to make it. He's never trying to make a coherent movie. Yeah, whereas Jurassic Park is a coherent movie. So I think it's on a different scale.
Okay.
And that it's, you know, a linear story that is easy, that is you can follow without.
Yeah, but you said there's nothing holding it together.
There's no real interesting idea holding it together.
Okay.
It's just, like I said, things happening in a linear fashion.
Okay.
And the things happening in Michael Bay movies are just more visually spectacular.
Okay. Yeah. So I thought you meant there wasn't really like a narrative. I can understand
this. Obviously, there's a very, very simple narrative, but there's a narrative.
Okay. You want to talk about some things I like about Jurassic Park?
Sure. Yeah, no. Go for it.
Have at it.
Yeah.
Okay. One thing I think a lot of people have pointed this out is kind of the crux of it. The whole point is the mosquito with the dinosaur blood.
Yep.
They dig it up, extract the blood, clone dinosaurs, you know.
Yeah.
Everything's great.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Everything goes well. Yeah. And I think that concept is cool for a summer blockbuster because it's, you know, just a simple enough concept. Like it's... would be very complicated to do, but to understand it is very simple.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Like, that's just the one point, and, yeah, even kids with very little understanding of science and stuff.
And when they explain that, it's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, sense. Why aren't we doing this?
They get trapped in sap. Obviously, the blood stays, and it's... I mean, I know how easy it is to find an isolated mosquito that was killed by sap recently, after recently biting a dinosaur. You know, like, makes sense. That's makes perfect sense.
Yeah. But yeah, I think one thing that people like about it, and I like about it, is that it is something that doesn't show up in other movies, that very simple concept.
Yep.
And, you know, so they have fun with a relatively new concept, more or less.
Yeah.
I think dinosaurs make great villains.
Yes.
I like dinosaurs.
Yes.
I probably wouldn't have been able to articulate this when I was younger. Like, I can't articulate the word articulate now.
Yeah.
Is that it's one of those interesting villains where, you know, they're not evil. They're just doing their thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the big force that they're having to deal with is dinosaurs. I guess the real villain is the greed and the short-sightedness of the people who made these dinosaurs. Yep. But, you know, for the running time, you're dealing with running away from dinosaurs, killing dinosaurs, hiding from dinosaurs.
It's like, you know, and I don't mean Predator like the movie, but it's the Predator villain. You know, it's just sort of like this is, a lot of these dinosaurs are natural predators, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of like the shark in Jaws.
You know? Yeah, and very, very exactly. Very similar to the shark in Jaws where it's a predator where there's never going to be a point of understanding.
Yep.
Like, just because there's no language, there's no communication, there's no the T-Rex saying, like, oh, you know, you're like, we have this in common, that's fine, go your own way.
Yeah, there's no, like, the psychologist scene from Psycho in this movie.
Yeah, it's a completely, you know, in a very real sense, a force of nature that you're just going to have to deal with, and you're never going to be able to negotiate with. And I think that makes her a very cool villain sometimes.
Okay.
You said Spielberg is kind of one of the big... you know, maybe recognized as one of the best American directors living right now.
I think to the common person, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. To the common person, that's what I was going to say. Maybe not critically so. But do you find it to be a particularly Spielbergian film?
Yes.
Spielberg-esque?
Yeah, and...
Spielbergeron? I think that's what it is. I saw
by
that
the
in
way,
Kaya Cinema.
I think I'm going to write like a play.
Yeah.
And it's going to be an adaptation. It's going to be Cyrano de Bergeron. I'm very excited. Oh my God.
Walsh and I were discussing a... we're going to write a fake biopic about Tom Bergeron.
Yeah. I love it. I love it.
And one scene starts with his inner monologue saying, "So there I am. Hosting with Whoopi at Center Square." At this point in my life, Whoopi was the center square of my life. Seems like a great line for Tom Bergeron.
The viral marketing campaign has officially started for the Tom Bergeron biopic.
Anyway, that's not directly related to this movie.
No.
Anyway, very Spielberg-y movie.
Yeah, I think so. And one of the things that's sort of been going around the internet, you know, starting in December, and I found it really interesting. It's sort of, have you seen this sort of like video essay about the Spielberg days?
No.
Okay, well, it's like one of Spielberg's visual tricks that he sort of relies on is sort of like cameras dollying into a character that's sort of looking at something and just being like in awe. And they sort of, it's like sort of following into them, or sorry, tracking into them, and it's their emotion and the idea is it's sort of reflecting how the audience is supposed to feel.
Yeah.
And that Spielberg's whole thing is trying to like get you to feel something. And I cannot believe I never noticed this before because it's constant
and
in Spielberg movies. Like, it's amazing.
And it's very like spoon feeding you. Like,
yeah,
this is how you should feel watching this.
Yeah.
And now this scene should evoke this emotion.
And I mean, that's my problem with with the Spielberg movies I don't like, is that it's very spoon fed and, like parts of it are very spoon fed. Like, I mean, I do like a lot of Spielberg, but I also dislike a lot. And I can't believe I didn't ever notice that.
Yeah.
And, I'm sure somebody must've written about it by now.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Like it,
I'm sure it's been covered.
And Jurassic Park, my God, there are so many of those.
Yeah.
Like, take a drink every time you get a Spielberg Gates shot in Jurassic Park. You won't make it 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, from the time they find the dinosaur, see the first dinosaur, the 20-minute mark, to the 25-minute mark, you'll get, like, 20 of them. It's insane.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's my whole thing with this movie, I guess, is that it's just sort of... it's like an amusement park ride, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just... And I mean, you can make that argument for a lot of blockbusters, yeah. But I think more so with this because it's a movie about an amusement park.
Yeah, it gets pretty crazy at one point where, with the amusement park stuff, and it is, it's Jurassic Park's supposed to be an amusement park that you take your family to, and the world of this narrative.
Yeah.
And when I was young, I went to Universal Studios mm-hmm. and rode the Jurassic Park actual ride and saw the animatronic T-Rex.
Yeah.
This all might be part of why I love this movie so much, and I'm well aware of this, but I stand by it. It was cool because it was, the amusement park ride of this movie about an amusement park. It's all very, sort of blockbustery in the sense that it's very much a product.
Yeah.
And Jurassic Park within Jurassic Park is a product.
Yeah.
And there's the one scene where they're still in the headquarters thing that they all meet up on and go through that amusement park ride in the movie, by the way, that explains how the science works. Yeah. Another amusement park.
Oh, just a quick thing about that. You know how John Hammond is supposed to take, like, John Hammond, Richard Attenborough's character, like the owner of Jurassic Park, is the idea that he's going to be there for every time somebody starts their tour of Jurassic Park?
Yeah,
like, because he's a part of that visual, there's the video of him, but it's supposed to interact with real him.
Really?
Is the idea that he's going to be there every time? Like, that is absurd. He also wants to be there for the birth of every dinosaur. Like, it's just all...
He's tired. He's got a lot of things to do. A lot of time to kill now.
Yeah. Oh, man. Anyway...
But yeah, I forget what point I was making now.
I don't care.
Stress.
It's close.
Apathetic.
We were talking about the amusement park and Universal Ride and how the movie is a product. And
right. Yeah. Anyway, so in that little building there where they eat and go on the ride and all that stuff, the main visitor center, I believe they call it, when they're first having their big business pitch about when they first arrive at Jurassic Park and, how this is going to make money and who's going to come and all that kind of stuff, there's merchandise for Jurassic Park, things that they would presumably sell in the gift shop at this place. And all of that merchandise was merchandise that you could buy for the movie Jurassic Park.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just so... Again, I don't know how else to say it, that it's just such a product. Like, it was thought up, let's make the movie, the video games, the ride, all the merchandise. Plug the merchandise into the movie for this weird Inception-level product placement that I can't even quite understand how it all works. I thought that was pretty interesting, too.
Yeah.
A big part of Jurassic Park, as we said, one of the things that I like about it, and a lot of people do, is that simple concept of it's this sort of this trick of science and then the ramifications of it.
Yeah.
And I think that a part of this movie and what made it so big and what people loved about it and... the reason it got made when it did is when CGI started being, really usable. It could really be the star of your movie.
Yep.
Was this the first CGI blockbuster? Like the first really big hit? I mean, we've always had special effects, obviously, and we have CGI in very limited places. But, a character like the T-Rex to be...
Fully CGI at times.
Yeah, for large parts of it to be entirely CGI. Is there another movie you can think of that is a CGI blockbuster to the same extent?
My idea is Terminator 2. I'm just looking up the date. 91. That's sort of where I think the CGI blockbuster starts. It's sort of like, the CGI in Terminator 2 is noticeably more limited than Jurassic Park.
Oh yeah.
The Abyss is sort of known as sort of a breakthrough for that, and then Terminator 2, but it's all sort of like the liquidy side, CGI, whereas
things that look fake.
Yeah,
like you're not replicating something that existed.
Yeah. And Jurassic Park is very much recognized as sort of kicking in the door for CGI, and there are reports of numbers of directors and people just sort of like being like, okay, now I can do this because this has been done.
Yeah.
George Lucas teared up the first time he saw the T-Rex, which is just such a George Lucas-y anecdote.
I love that anecdote.
Yeah. And he realized he could do the prequels after seeing this, but Kubrick realized he could do AI. Peter Jackson decided to get more into fantasy stuff as opposed to the horror films he was making.
Yep.
So thanks, Steve. But
it very, very important in filmmaking.
In CGI, right? Yeah. And so you're right. There definitely was sort of a foundation laid for these movies. It's not the first CGI movie by any means. But I think to have such a central character or certain scenes so, you know, dependent on CGI working, I think was a big, you know, as you said, a big part of this.
Yeah. And I mean, there's only about like 16 minutes of the movie, I think, was the number where there are actually dinosaurs on screen. Which is not a high percentage. And even when they're on screen, they're not always CGI. When you're seeing a full dinosaur on screen, that's CGI. Yeah. When you're seeing parts of a dinosaur, it's an animatronic.
Yeah.
And I think that that's part of the key to the movie is that there are very few scenes that really use a lot of CGI. It's just sort of the herd and the T-Rex chase are really the only scenes where you get an extended amount. Mm-hmm. You get some CGI raptors in the kitchen. Well, I guess you get a lot of that. But yeah, other than those three sequences, I can't think of extensive CGI. The Brachiosaur doing the wheelie.
Yeah. And, I mean, to me, the herd scenes and the CGI ones are the ones that really don't hold up.
No, absolutely.
which is what's funny about this movie.
Yeah, well, anything that's sort of brand new technology-wise won't be good in 20 years.
Yeah.
Anything that's cutting edge looks amazing at the time, but it ages significantly quicker than anything else.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Avatar's going to look like crap in 3 years, you know?
So.
Oh, yeah. By the time Avatar 2 comes out...
Yeah. Avatar.
Yeah. Avatar. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. Well, the one thing, I have a couple things to say.
That's the price of modernity is that it ages quicker.
Yeah, I don't know. I look at kind of the CGI in this movie in a couple ways. I mean, there's interesting ways to look at, I think. One thing, well, do you remember the speech that Jeff Goldblum's character, Dr. Ian Malcolm?
Thank you, Dr. Ian Malcolm. Probably do. I rewound many of them.
Okay. The one he gives, like, kind of the first time he really goes off on how bad of an idea this would be to him, and it says something like, you stood on the shoulders of geniuses just took the next step. You spent so much time worrying about whether or not you could do it. You spent no time worrying about whether you should do it.
Yep. I like that a lot.
Yeah. I like it a lot, too. And, again, something I wouldn't have ever thought of at the time and wouldn't even made sense when I was young. But the way we look at CGI now, and as we said before, this kind of kicked the door down for everyone saying, like, let's make a CGI-based movie.
Yep.
And, I mean, when we think the last blockbusters of the, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, it's hard to find one that isn't even... has no CGI, let alone majority of CGI,
I mean, The Dark Knight is the closest to... a more organic action movie. And I mean, even from looking at the Dark Knight Rises trailer, that's clearly not going to be the case in the next one. Clearly like we're well past that.
Yeah. And I don't think this would ever have been written into the script or, them have it in mind at the time, but I see it as kind of, Dr. Ian Malcolm talking about CGI to an extent.
Yep. No, I see that for sure.
Yeah. And saying, you know, yes, you can do this, but what is this going to mean for everything else? I mean, even if this movie looks good now or if this movie looks good forever, what are the implications for other people doing this? And the funny part is that, you know, Lucas and Spielberg are both involved in this movie. Mm-hmm. Lucas finished directing because Spielberg said...
I don't know that he finished directing, but he, like, monitored post-production.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure Spielberg still had the final say, because I just read that today, and I was just like, okay, yeah. So he went off to make Schindler's List, but I'm sure he was keeping tabs on it.
Okay.
He's not like, okay, post-production, I'm out of here. I don't do post.
Well, yeah, and I just think it's so funny, because those two guys, I mean, especially, I think Lucas is a great example, he fell victim to it as well. I mean, he's someone who... use CGI very poorly later on in his career. A lot of people feel, I mean, the first three Star Wars, all the prequels, people feel it's just so much CGI that just doesn't look good. Even when it came out, it's not even that it didn't hold up. When it came out, people said, this looks terrible, this looks unnatural, this looks inorganic, there's nothing that I can believe about looking at this.
Yeah, and the idea with the Star Wars prequels, part of the reason why it looks so... they just don't feel right is because there's just so much going on, and that is a CGI thing.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if I've said this before on the podcast, but this is one of my favorite movie related ideas I've heard in a long time. Like a year ago, Patton Oswalt said, comedian/awesome movie thinker, said this thing about, the reason people didn't like those movies is because George Lucas could do whatever, he could actually do whatever he wants. And this point relates back to Spielberg as well, because they were talking, he was talking about the idea of Jaws being remade. And he says that Spielberg is the greatest living filmmaker, Oswald says. You have to get the right Spielberg, and you have to get the young Spielberg that has to deal with problems, like the Jaws shark not working, or, working in whatever location in Indiana Jones was shot in with the limited technology you had in 1980, 81, whatever. Whereas you sort of like flash to now where he's making Tintin, and which I didn't see. I've heard good things about, and I'm interested in seeing. But Spielberg's making Tintin, and he's just motion capturing his actors, and then he can do whatever he wants. Like, anything he wants. And Oswald's argument is that the reason the first 20 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, the beach scene, is so incredible is because that's when you're getting back old Spielberg or young Spielberg, because he's got so many problems he has to deal with. He's got to deal with constantly changing weather. You can only do so much on a beach in general. You know, it's sort of his idea is that your first idea isn't always great. You need to have a few shitty ideas that you can't do before you've settled on something that you can actually do, and then that'll work. And it's sort of his ideas that Spielberg specifically, and I assume this applies to Lucas as well, need that limitation. To sort of have not their first idea work, but their third idea work.
Yeah.
And I think that's an amazing point, and I think it's so correct.
I don't think you've said that on here either, because I think that's news to me. You know, the Academy, Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences?
Yeah.
Let's go with that.
Just call it the Academy.
No, but I mean, it's, and sciences is the point that I'm trying to get at. That is part of it, and special effects, CGI, is a science.
Yep.
And, you know, in this movie, we see scientists, people trying to take a shortcut and, you know, make something that's not really there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, all special effects are a lie. All of film is a lie.
Yeah,
I mean,
of course.
Jeff Goldblum isn't on the screen. He's, you know, a bunch of light in the shape of him. Yeah. Even when you're using animatronics, you are asking someone to believe a bunch of rubber and metal is a triceratops. But, I mean, that's dishonest in a certain way. And I don't mean that negatively, just, you know, neutrally, that is dishonest. Mm. But I think that asking someone to believe that a bunch of pixels somewhere is, you know, a T-Rex is a different kind of dishonesty, like a more fundamental dishonesty. And again, not that it's morally worse or anything, you know, push science as far as you can. You know, let's see. I mean, that's science is the point of it. But as he's saying, this, as Dr. Ian Malcolm says in the quote, I mean, it's, you didn't think about whether you could. You thought about, I mean, you didn't think about whether you should. You thought about whether you could.
Yeah.
And what we see on screen when we see CGI isn't, it's nothing, you know.
It's
the way that these people in this movie didn't recreate dinosaurs. They created something and called them dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And in the same way that I think that's the difference between a model and a miniature, which is still a lie, and a complete subversion of reality and perception by having something be CGI.
No, I agree with that.
And, and it shows up a couple times. It's funny, some of the characters and stuff, unless some of the scientists are named after people involved in the crew. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, when we see these scenes of them with the eggs and all the scientists going to work, it reminds me so much of all these people working at computers to put together a film like this with such an insane amount of work, especially in the early 90s, to get all the CGI going. And another thing, too, the kind of to look at it as kind of the park of Jurassic Park is an abstract version of the movie itself, is dinosaurs are kind of like a blockbuster movie in this case. You know, it's this really big, loud thing that all these scientists threw a bunch of money at to hope it comes together in an interesting way. In the way that even this park functions, it was supposed to be a very expensive park visited by people all around the world, which is the business model of making a blockbuster today. To make a really, really big, expensive movie, you have to have an action movie that it's, you know, the international market in on it too.
Yep.
And just all the ways that they try to utilize these dinosaurs in this park is the way that the modern blockbuster functions now. It's, we see in that movie, that scene that I talked about before, it's merchandised, from the get-go. It's very big, it's very expensive, and a lot of it now is more about the work of scientists than it is of creative people. And, you know, it's all these scientists who made these dinosaurs, and it's what you, when you go to the movie theater in the summer and you see these big expensive movies, Michael Bay's the director or whoever is the big action director, Roland Emmerich. But so much of what you're being exposed to is the work of scientists. And I know we don't call computer programmers scientists all the
time. Roland Emmerich has no scientists on his staff. Did you see The Day After Tomorrow? I'm sorry, continue.
No, but I mean, I think that's what I'm trying to get at is just as a good metaphor for itself in a weird way that I don't think that they could have predicted at the time as much, not as much as 20 years later, but I think it functions as a very oddly pertinent metaphor for itself and what happened to the action blockbuster.
I agree, and Steven Spielberg has said, one, that Richard Attenborough, who is also a director, is, you know, one of his influences, and he has also said that, Ian Malcolm stands in for Michael Crichton. Michael Crichton's ideas mostly come through Ian Malcolm.
Yeah.
And Steven Spielberg sort of envisioned John Hammond as himself.
Yeah.
And I think that's totally interesting. And that leads into my kind of only point about this movie. Jurassic Park is Avatar.
Is it?
And you hate Avatar. If you were six and you saw Avatar, you'd lose your fucking mind.
I know, but I feel like if you were 22 and you saw Jurassic Park, you'd like it the way you like Transformers. Like, you would say, yeah, I see what the criticisms are. I can see why a bunch of, more artistically minded critics would say, oh, this is just a bunch of action. This is pure spectacle. This is just the same thing as an amusement park ride. Mm. But that's what I was trying to negotiate, your difference between your Michael Bay love and this love. And I'm not saying that you would just take a contrarian standpoint and, you know, they like it, so I'm going to hate it, or they hate it, so I'm going to like it. But I think if you saw this, you know, now, you'd just say, like, say you saw it in 1993, but it was when you were, you know, 24, 25 or something. Yeah. I think you would say that was the fun ride. There was some cool science in it. There were some cool ideas. I've never seen an action sequence like that. Like, the T-Rex set piece in the Jeep is incredible.
Okay. No, I think...
You've already conceded that point. I'm just saying, I think that there would be enough there that you, like, post-film class can say, like, I'm just going to sit back and... Again, maybe we've overused this metaphor, but enjoy the ride. Okay, and that's very much what this movie is.
No, I totally see that. And I thought about the context of our age, like, you know, seeing Jurassic Park 6 or 7 years old and seeing Avatar 22, 23, or even older maybe. But I thought about our age of watching those. I didn't think about the filmmaking world context. Whereas, the late 80s is sort of notorious as a terrible time for film.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason why people were really allowed to have, you know, their minds blown by some of these action movies in the early 90s, like Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park. And I think that's the thing. I don't know that I would necessarily love action movies like I do if I didn't grow up in the 90s. And I think Jurassic Park is a big part of it.
Okay.
I think... As far as the technology, everything you said about the technology in Jurassic Park, I think it can be totally 100% applied to Avatar, though. And I don't think you would disagree.
Yeah, but I mean, there's just some parts that are that work so well as that metaphor.
Yeah,
like
the
dinosaur blockbuster thing. And I was going to get to that point. I actually forgot to write it down, but about Hammond being Spielberg. Mm. He's like, he's got a beard and he's got white hair and he's like in charge of all these people. Like, he's telling all these scientists what to do and how to make this really exciting, amazing product that the whole world is going to want to see.
Yep.
I
agree. And I didn't think of that before I read it, even though I've been known to look for stand-ins for Spielberg. Listen to our last Spielberg podcast.
Yeah. I guess we briefly breezed over Ian Malcolm, but that's not doing him justice.
Well, we need to split this into two parts if we're going to start talking about Ian Malcolm. That is the one part of this movie that I just, well, I mean, other than...
Join us?
I suppose the kitchen sequence I love.
Join us on our Goldblum cast.
Yeah.
Every Thursday.
No. Ian Malcolm is the one thing I passionately, passionately love about Jurassic Park. Jeff Goldblum is amazing.
It was during the 90s when Jeff Goldblum convinced the world he was an action star, and nobody argued with him because he crushed it when he needed to.
He was the lead in The Fly in 86 too, right? That was sort of a blockbuster.
Is that action-y
movie.
Though?
It was a blockbuster-y movie.
Okay.
I mean, I haven't seen it, so I can't say. And it's sort of just Jurassic Park, The Lost World, and Independence Day.
Yeah. And JP3.
He's not in Jurassic Park 3.
JP2?
Yeah, The Lost World.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Thought you meant the novel by Michael Crichton. He's a big character.
Which, actually, The Lost World is probably the novel I've read the most times in my life. I was a huge fan of that novel. Yeah. I also don't read a lot of fiction qualifier, but
Michael Crichton has mad love for that novel.
Yeah, I like The Lost World as a novel.
That's why it's called The Lost World, and his description of, like, he just kind of, not steals, but I guess pays homage is the nice way to say, takes to a lot Sir of the descriptions. Conan Doyle. Yeah, and Arthur Conan Doyle describes the T-Rex as, like, the sound of approaching thunder, which we get a lot of in the movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
The set piece in The Lost World of their little trailer thing going over the edge.
It's awesome.
That's awesome.
Oh, no, it's great.
Okay.
In the Jurassic Park series, that is the best set piece.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
I watched it again. I remember really liking that part and then being blown away by how much I enjoyed it. The only bad part is what sets that up is...
I haven't seen that movie since I was a kid, by the way. I just recently saw it again with my sister on TV. Saw the last, like, 20 minutes, but...
Julianne Moore is all upset about people... you know, coming to this island and not documenting, but getting themselves involved, and then picks up a baby T-Rex and brings it into the trailer to fix its leg.
Yeah.
Anyway. What do you like so much about Jeff Goldblum in this?
I mean, I just love Jeff Goldblum, and it's just, he's got that real sort of, I love the core. Like, he's got sort of, I don't know. Like, I don't know.
It's tough to describe.
He's kind of a cocky guy. But he's also got a lot of Woody Allen in him, you know, like, and it's sort of like kind of fumbling over his own words, but a conscious fumbling.
Yeah.
And
I've never seen someone able to act so genuinely perplexed. Like, there are times in that movie where I don't even think he knows where he is. He's so genuinely confused and amazed by what's happening. And it's not the dinosaurs. It's like the actions of people around him that get him so, so messed up.
Yeah. And I just remember he's so removed from a lot of things in this movie. Like, when they're just sort of, they're all marveling at the hatching of the baby raptor or whatever, and he's sort of just doing a slow circle of thinking and saying things like, yeah, but of course, you know, like, that type of thing. And he's just awesome. And, yeah, I mean, I can see how he became an action movie semi-staple for a bit, though.
Yeah.
I can totally see it.
He's a good straight man, but still funny.
Yeah, he's very engaging. He's very charismatic. And he is kind of built, like... he's got, like, really broad shoulders.
Yeah, he's a big dude.
Yeah. And, I mean, he's not super muscular or anything, but he's built kind of like a slim action hero.
Yeah, and he puts himself together for the action movies, at least.
Yeah. We should stop there for the Malcolm stuff.
Okay. Do we want to talk about the Michael Crichton family feminism stuff?
Of course.
Okay. We talked a bit about Spielberg.
Yeah.
And one of his Spielbergeron reoccurring motifs, if you will.
Sure.
I guess reoccurring motifs is a bit redundant. Anyway, is kind of the father relationship.
Yep.
And the family dynamic.
Yeah.
And do we get any of that in this movie?
Oh, totally. I mean, even just from Grant hating kids and learning to love them, you know, like with Tim and Lex.
Yeah.
Even just, I mean, there's that, and there's also, there's sort of a quick mention of early on of, Hammond not being at that dig to meet Gennaro, the lawyer, at the very, very beginning, because he wants to be with his daughter who's going through a divorce.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of family stuff in that movie. And, I mean, this is far less important, but, Jeff Goldblum always being on the lookout for a future Mrs. X Malcolm or X Mrs. Malcolm.
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines in the movie.
Yeah. And, we get a lot of that coming through from just the novel that it's adapted from.
Yeah.
Because, again, Spielberg will insert that into the things he makes himself. But the themes are very present in the book by Michael Crichton.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote about this a little bit, so you can check the website if you want to see more about it. But Michael Crichton is a... was, I suppose.
Yeah.
now deceased.
Yep.
A vocal anti-feminist. Said that the feminist movement probably did more damage than it did good. And, yeah, just a lot of things that maybe, some liberal Hollywood types maybe wouldn't have agreed with this much, but, he did very well getting his scripts, his novels adapted into Hollywood films
and having his novels sell
Yeah,
separately.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And, so I read a good essay about this, so if you want to read very in-depth on this subject, you can read There Is No Unauthorized Breeding in Jurassic Park, which is a line from the film, and that's when Dr. Ian Malcolm wants to know how they can control the population of, you know, these animals that are in these huge cages and, you know, intermingle with other genders and other species and things like that. And the doctor's response is there's no unauthorized breeding in Jurassic Park because all the dinosaurs are bred to be female.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is...
By the way, the hilariously ideal scientist played by B.D. Wong. Like, my God, that guy's just... He just looks like sunshine.
Yeah. It's all good. Yeah. They're dinosaurs.
They're all female.
What could happen?
So how do you know? Are you going around lifting up the dinosaur skirts?
They're wearing skirts. They're probably females anyway. Exactly. But...
Doesn't he know anything about genders?
About dinosaur clothing. Yeah, and... That line kind of speaks to one of the underlying ideas that Michael Crichton is not shied away from when asked about it. But this movie in the novel is very much about sticking to defined gender roles. So if all these female dinosaurs choose to stay female and, you know, do female things, there won't be any more breeding. The population will stay exactly the same and everything will be under control the way that they wanted it to. Mm-hmm. But what happened is when they extract the DNA from the mosquitoes, there are some gaps in the genetic code. So they insert some DNA from tree frogs because, you know, they're kind of like dinosaurs because they're lizards.
Yep.
They ended up choosing a frog that changes gender partway through its life. And so some of the dinosaurs become male and they can breed. What, you think scientists should know these things?
Yes. Okay. The scientists that are using this
splicing
DNA
genetic code
to make fucking dinosaurs. Yes, I do think that should happen. They should know this. And I think that's the theme of the movie is evolution and adapting. And I mean, you can apply that to your theory on CGI as well. The whole movie's about evolving, and, I mean, there's that line where, you know, I mean, it's mostly science evolving, but we do see natural evolution.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they are breeding in the movie. Yeah, I forgot. He finds the eggs and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Matter after eggs.
Yeah. It's sort of about evolution, and there's that sort of idea that, you know, Sattler and Grant are out of a job because of Hammond making dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Science. And
who wants to go to a museum when you can go to Jurassic Park?
Exactly.
And see them.
And that's one of the, like, there are a lot of little clever things throughout this movie that I really enjoy. Like, objects in the mirror are closer than they appear with the T-Rex chase, you know, the ripples in the water. I really enjoy. One thing that I noticed recently that I really love is when the helicopter is landing on Jurassic Park for the first time and they're sort of buckling up their seatbelts.
Yeah, I was going to mention this one. It's one of my favorite little visual things.
It's great. Grant's seatbelt doesn't work because he's got two female ends.
Yeah.
And what does he do? He ties them together and makes it work.
Yeah.
And that's what the dinosaurs end up doing.
Exactly. Yeah. And I flew over my head probably, I don't know how many times that I watched it.
Yeah,
but
flew over my head for 18 years.
Yeah. And yeah, it's, you know, they make it work. Dr. Ian Malcolm's whole thing is that nature finds a way, and that's something he says. That's his mantra that he never forgets, Jeff Goldblum.
Nature finds a way. Life finds a way.
That'll be my last Jeff Goldblum terrible impression, I promise. Okay. And that's what the whole movie's about. It does find a way. And yeah, I think I never really pieced that together, but you could apply it to the blockbuster thing. It's whatever's going to make money, whatever's going to work, even if it's not perfect visually, it's going to be the cheaper thing that gets results that ends up making money, and Hollywood's a business.
Yep. Another thing, just a quick thing with the kids, when Lex and Tim show up, it's so funny. Grant's face in the background, like, because the camera's when they cut back to the stairs where they're coming down, it focuses on Attenborough's character, Hammond. The face Grant makes when those kids show up is so funny. He is petrified. It's amazing. I'll try and remember to do a screen cap for the website.
Yeah.
God, it's funny. But, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Another thing, I mean, about him hating children, we kind of brushed over kind of some of the gender roles, but there was some more kind of family roles and about staying in, you know, dads being dads and kids being kids and mothers being mothers. As you said, right off the get-go, Grant's not too big on the whole notion of getting married or having kids or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, I know I did, just assume that...
him and Sadler were dating.
Him and Sadler are dating. That's not a thing. They're just coworkers.
Yeah.
She has someone she's seeing. A nice doctor from Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And you see him in Jurassic Park 3.
Yeah, no, I knew that.
He's changed from a doctor. But anyway. off the start, he really doesn't want to take on this father role. And mm-hmm. Tim's a big part. Tim's a big dinosaur fan.
Yeah.
And, you know, to meet...
Has read Grant's book.
Yeah, to meet Alan Grant, to be a kid like that would be a pretty big deal. So he's, you know, asking him a lot of questions and trying to spend time with them. And Dr. Alan Grant just moves from vehicle to vehicle, trying to ditch the kid, essentially. And
also, a funny moment in that, in the background, when Lex shows up there, she walks up to Ian Malcolm, and Jeff Goldblum holds out his hand to, like, shake her hand, and it's just so funny. It's just like, oh, hey, kid.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, so we get Dr. Alan Grant kind of just rejecting this role as a father and not really wanting it. And again, as happens... it kind of slowly progresses to him being more and more open to the idea. Eventually, he's in charge of the two kids, and it's kind of up to him to be the one who provides for them and protects them and stuff. There's that scene in the when the Jeep gets thrown off that bridge with the T-Rex, and it's high up in the tree there, and it's just Timmy and Grant up in the car. And they talk about they're trying to get down, and Timmy says how scared he is, and Dr. Alan Grant says, "Didn't you ever build a tree fort with your dad?" And, you know, we just get this idea of family and fatherhood and all this kind of stuff, and all these other people seem to be, the people we don't see who get talked about seem to be failing this notion of family, mm-hmm. and Alan Grant just seems to be rejecting it. And really, the only time that they end up surviving all these dinosaurs is when Grant, Sadler, Tim, and Lex kind of form a very heteronormative, you know, patriarchal family where he's in charge, he's protecting them, and the two kids end up becoming safe for that reason.
Yep.
And, you know, they're... all the kids are big nerds, too, to tie in with the science thing, too. And, you know, it's this science... It works for them and works against them in this movie, so it's tough to say where this movie lands as far as the science debate. Where do you think it would fit in on the spectrum?
I don't know, because it really does go back and forth. I think the movie ends on being, I think it's sort of, the ending is like, science is good, but be careful, you know? And because Hammond at the end is sort of like, you know, Grant hops in the Jeep, I don't think I'm going to endorse your park or whatever. Yeah. Hammond's like, don't worry about it. Like he's comfortable with the idea that this park is not going to exist. But he's also, you know, he also takes a look back, you know, before they get on the helicopter and, yeah.
Yeah. And I think
just sort of like science is cool, but you know, think about it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what Ian Malcolm seems to be saying to a lot of people. He's, in the novel, it's a bit, you get a bit more of this, but he's, very into computers and very into science as well. And it's not just kind of abstract thinking. He does sort of apply things in the novel, which just doesn't get touched on that much in the movie. But he is pro-science, and he has no problem, you know, furthering human nature. Human knowledge as a doctor. It's what he does. But I think, as you said, as he says often, it's that science is just an extension of mankind.
Yeah.
And it's only ever going to be as good or as positive as the people who design it and the people who use it. And that's, I think that's just a point that comes through, that even though this movie is about science, it's about the people who use it. And, Wayne Knight.
Yep. Playing Dennis Nedry. Best known as Newman.
Yes. Almost only known as Newman. Yeah, and he's in JFK too. You love JFK. And I mean, that's another thing. He's a very knowledgeable person, but again, it's just his greed that gets the best of him and ends up kind of setting this whole park into chaos.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to talk about Dodson? Not much to say.
We don't have him here, so we can't do the quote. I have a question for you.
Sure.
Would you rather be, and this is apart from Jurassic Park, but this is the real life. Would you rather be Richard Attenborough or David Attenborough? Would you rather have been in Jurassic Park and directed Gandhi and done whatever else Richard did, mm-hmm. or would you be the voice of Planet Earth?
For sure. Yeah. I don't know. Hmm. Do I get a free copy of Planet Earth?
Don't you have a copy? Do you need it?
I need a Blu-ray copy.
Okay.
Did you have another question?
No.
How do you feel?
I don't know. I'd go with Richard.
You probably want to do a filmmaker. Yeah. A cool thing about this is one of the big things people take away from this movie and people remember about this movie is the raptors.
Yep.
And I thought it was cool that you don't even see a raptor till about like 111 minutes into this movie or something.
103.
Yeah. Okay. Ooh, now who's the JP fan? But as you said,
I happened to be watching it about the hour mark and reading about it when that happened. So I was like, I'm going to check the time when this shows up.
Okay. But as you kind of said earlier, going back to the CGI thing, you do get a good view of the dinosaurs and they're very much stars of the movie, but I think they're in it a lot less than people think.
Yep. It's like the Hannibal Lecter thing. It's just whatever's the most memorable.
Yeah.
It's just that the dinosaurs are so memorable and Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal Lecter was so memorable that you forget it was all about catching Ted Gum or whatever his name was. Yeah. I think I'm mixing my names of serial killers, but yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of, people say that this, I mean, maybe you might feel this way too, but this is bad Spielberg. This is Spielberg too old that he's doing things wrong and really just, milking things, and people kind of want to say, you know, go back to Jaws. And the thing that people always say works so well for Jaws was that you don't see the shark very much. Mm-hmm. They have to wait for a very long time, and it, you know, it pops up when it matters the most. Do you think people kind of underappreciate that about this movie, that you don't see the raptors for till very late, and you never really see dinosaurs for that long either?
No, I don't think you should necessarily, like, I think it's more about the whole feeling that the movie gives you than, I think if you're conscious of when the creatures show up, I think that's worse. And I think it's sort of, it speaks to how good the scenes are with the raptors that people forget that it doesn't happen until there's 20 minutes left in the movie.
Yeah.
And I think that's more impressive to me than being like, oh my God, it's been 40 minutes. Where the hell are the raptors?
Okay. You know? Yeah. Do you want to talk about the ending?
Yeah, that's a big problem I have with it. This movie doesn't really have a climax.
No.
It has an action sequence that just sort of ends. You know, it doesn't, it's like what is a bigger form of deus ex machina than running? Is that how to pronounce it?
Some people say deus.
Okay. Yeah, that would make more sense, I guess. But anyways, you're just sort of running away from raptors and, oh, T-Rex just swoops in, eats them, done.
Continue.
And the movie's about adapting, right?
Yeah.
And the humans never really adapt to, you know, the situation. I recognize it's a very difficult situation they're in.
To live in.
But I think the only satisfying ending is the humans getting away with no help from a dinosaur. Because if it's all about evolving and then something that's a part of their habitat comes in, stomps it out with the T-Rex. Right. I think that's just so deflating, and it just really hammers home that they were just running through this amusement park and just running as fast as they could trying to get through it. They don't really, like, you know, Sattler turns on the power to the rest of the parks.
And Lexi nerds it up on the computer.
Yeah, with her hacking skills.
Yep.
There's that type of stuff. But as far as the final moment being determined by, you know, not the humans and the people we're supposed to identify with, I don't like it. I think it's a total letdown.
Okay, I think that I agree with almost all of what you said. I think it is absolutely a climax. I think maybe it's a cheap climax.
It is a climax, but it's a climax that's not good.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. I just feel that it's kind of one of the most climactic climaxes ever. With the T-Rex going down, with the banner of when dinosaurs ruled the earth going, with the John Williams score peaking. Yeah. Like, I think that is a climax. I'd agree that, yes, it probably isn't the most deserved climax and is a little deflating, but I think it's climactic for sure. I think it certainly peaks at a point and then, you know, the plot closes down and that's that.
And I think that's sort of my, and there's that really quick epilogue and there's sort of... Ellie has found a way to found time to slick back her hair really quick. Yeah, and I guess that sort of stands to my whole point, is that the reason I don't love this movie the way most people do, well, particularly now, is that I don't find a lot interesting thematically.
Okay.
And the thing that is interesting about this movie thematically is the evolution idea, these things evolving, and what wins out is the CGI that you're like, luck, and the CGI that you're like, well, think about what you're doing with this stuff first, you know? And I think it's just totally deflating. It's a deflating ending, and I'll argue that until the day I die.
Okay, well, I think that, we were on both, I think we stayed on the sides that we're on. I think we found some common ground about what we
dislike
about the ending.
It's not like you think this is a flawless movie and I think it's the worst movie ever made. It's far from that.
Yeah, it's true. We're more in the middle than I think we say.
Yeah.
But,
I just think it's a middling movie. You know, like, I think it's middle of the ground with some, or, you know, middle ground with some really, really impressive stuff.
Okay.
Really good sequences. Without Ian Malcolm, all these characters are boring.
Okay.
And it's only because of Jeff Goldblum, I think, that he's particularly interesting.
Okay, probably. Yeah. All right. Well, I think we settled that.
Yeah. Jim and I are going to go have a knife fight to really settle this once and for all, though. I just don't really feel the point of putting that on an audio medium. But thank you for listening to the McGuffin.
What? Podcast High Five?
Sure. thank you for listening to the Guffin Men, and depending on who wins the knife fight, one of us will be back next week, so be sure to check back to see who wins.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by the Final Destination series. By the way, can anyone tell us what the word final means? Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.